On Tuesday, President Joe Biden signed 4 new executive orders to address systemic racism and racial inequity.
I'm not promising we can end it tomorrow, but I promise you we're going to continue to make progress to eliminate systemic racism, and every branch of the White House and the federal government is going to be part of that effort.
The orders include housing policies to prevent discrimination, an end to private federal prisons, respecting sovereignty of Native American tribes, and fighting discrimination against Asian Americans. These steps by the Biden administration come after 4 years of a Trump administration where racial tensions were inflamed. But it's going to take a lot more than 4 executive actions to fix systemic racism in this country, and civil rights leaders are hoping to see more from the new administration. I'm Tanzina Vega, and the Biden administration's approach to racial equity is where we start today on The Takeaway. For more, I'm joined by Dr. Kelly Carter-Jackson, a historian and professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Kelly, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We also have Russell Contreras, the justice and race reporter at Axios. Russell, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
And Dr. Niambi Carter is an associate professor of political science at Howard University. Niambi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll give you the first question, Niambi. How is the administration defining racial equity?
Well, I think it's been really interesting to see this administration seem to take the systemic approach to equity rather than the sort of individual bad actor approach. I think it's clear that they know that they can't change individual opinions, but they can at least address some of the sort of federal policies that have led us here.
Kelly, do you think the Biden administration is meeting expectations on racial equity so far? And we should be clear, the Biden administration has been in office for, what, 2 weeks? So
it's a little much
to ask that, but so far.
Well, I mean, I'll say this, that the Biden administration clearly has a mandate from the Black community. We know that the Black community was instrumental in bringing about Joe Biden's campaign and even his presidency. And so he definitely will have to speak to some of the issues and the grievances in the Black community, probably more than any other president. And so the expectations are high. I think he's trying to get out the gate running, but we'll see what happens, you know, particularly in these next 100 days, what his platform looks like.
Russell, who are the key players in shaping the Biden administration's racial equity agenda so far?
Well, it's domestic policy advisor Susan Rice. She's the one that introduced these executive orders in a conference call with the reporters. And Vice President Kamala Harris, she's definitely playing a role in here. But you have a number of people who have been appointed and who are waiting confirmation. Also, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. She's someone who's been very outspoken on indigenous issues. She's a congresswoman here in New Mexico. So he's putting together a diverse group of folks to advise him on these things. And this is kind of a down payment on what's to come in the future of administration, according to these officials.
And Kelly, in your experience, I mean, there have been presidents who have talked about racial equity, or I should say racial inequity. Have we seen a president address it this quickly out of the gate?
You know, no, I don't think we can. I think even when we think about President Obama, you know, there was a lot of distancing that he did to try to say, I'm not, you know, the president of Black America. I'm the president of all America. I have to address all American issues. So I think that Biden will have a completely different, you know, set of expectations, given that he doesn't have to navigate around a Black identity like Obama did. But also coming off of the Trump administration, there's been so much harm that's been done that has to be remedied or rectified immediately or very soon. And so I think the stakes are much higher. I think the stakes are different.
Niambi, your thoughts on that? Because I'm wondering if that, I mean, there is such a different place that we are right now after 4 years of the Trump administration than what President Obama, being the first Black president of this country, really had to navigate. So is the pump primed, if you will, for Biden to really take this on?
I think so. I mean, I think there's certainly an appetite for it. We saw the events of the summer. I mean, I think we saw sort of these tepid attempts under the Clinton administration when they did the One America report that was headed by preeminent Black historian John Hope Franklin, but nothing really sort of happened out of it. And so I think we have as much momentum as we're probably going to get in this country, or at least that we've seen in recent memory. And so this is, I think, a moment for Biden to press the gas, because the voters that put him in office in Georgia, in Philadelphia, in Michigan, right, they want to see this. Right. They want someone to talk about anti-aging sentiment. They want somebody to take seriously the issue of housing discrimination and reparations and all these other things. So he has as close to a positive path forward as we're going to probably see for a very long time in this country. And I suggest he keeps going full throttle here.
Russell, let's talk a little bit about the specific orders. One of the executive orders Biden signed was aiming to end contracts between private prisons and the Justice Department. This, however, does not apply to immigration detention centers. So what does that signal right now about the Biden administration on ICE detention?
It signals that he still has a lot of work to do to come up with an immigration reform package, mm-hmm. and that putting undocumented immigrants in some of these private prisons is something he's kicking down the road. But he wanted to send a message that he didn't like the fact that the federal government has these contracts with private prisons. Now, the private prison industry pushed back and said, look, we're not involved in the, quote, mass incarceration, unquote, of people, meaning they don't even agree with the concept. And they said, look, the main deal we have with the federal government is the detention of immigrants. So they pushed back hard on this, but it did signal to some activists that the fact that he acknowledged private prisons play a role in what we have, this mass incarceration problem that is disproportionately affecting communities of color, is something he wants to tackle right out the gate.
Also, Russell, he signed an executive order on Native American tribal sovereignty, something we've been covering Native American communities here on the show quite a bit. That feels like it is a departure from current federal policy. How much of it would you assess that is?
Well, it's a broad assessment that he wants to engage in tribal communities, but he did want to signal that this is a change of tone from Donald Trump. Look, Donald Trump said many offensive things while he was in office. Even having the portrait of President Andrew Jackson in his office and above events with Native Americans sent a message that angered a lot of tribal governments and tribal members. So this is an attempt to change that tone. But I got to tell you, there are some activists that were expecting him to go further. I talked to Nick Tilson from the Lakota Nation, and he said, look, give us Black Hills back. Let's give us Mount Rushmore back. That's our land. That's ours. That should be something he signaled, but he wasn't going to go that far. And the fact that he did say he wanted to engage tribal communities was a step forward for some activists.
We're going to be talking a lot about these executive orders down the pike, but there's another one, Kelly. I'm curious your thoughts here. President Biden wanted to sign an anti-discrimination housing policy executive order. That is also something that the Obama administration weighed in on, really trying to fortify anti-discrimination housing policies. The Trump administration pulled back on some of those. Where does this kind of leave that issue right now?
Well, you know, I think it remains to be seen. Housing discrimination is a really big deal, and we are still living with the effects of redlining and segregation that took place, you know, over 50, 60 years ago. So undoing a lot of the harm that has happened, particularly even if you think about the economic crisis of 2008 and how many African Americans and Latino Americans lost their homes and have not recovered from those foreclosures and from those losses. There's a lot that has to be done in order to remedy this. And it can't be something that is just symbolic. It really has to be substantive and supply the financial resources to get people back on their feet.
Niambi, there was another executive order about instructing the Department of Health and Human Services to investigate a troubling trend since the beginning, particularly of the coronavirus, violence and discrimination against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Remind us again the significance of this, particularly after the Trump administration, and how the Trump administration really may have further alienated this community.
Well, certainly the United States has a long history of anti-Asian sentiment from the Yellow Peril to, you know, contemporary moments. But you had Donald Trump and others from the administration calling it the China virus, the Wuhan virus, rather than COVID-19. So they racialized this illness and, you know, really marked this community as sort of carriers of disease. And when doing that, of course, it creates this sort of suspicion that Asian people are, in fact, foreign, first of all, not citizens of the United States, and that they are carriers of disease. So I think trying to address the very real discrimination that Asians are experiencing, not just as a result of this moment, but I think over the longer arc, will do a lot to sort of, I think, broaden our discussion of what racial equity can look like, because I think much of it is focused on, say, Blacks and Latinos, but there are Indigenous communities and Asian communities that are racialized also, even though differently than these other communities.
It's a really important point. Russell, your thoughts on that, because you've covered race and ethnicity. I've covered it across the country as well. And I do think the Biden administration is signaling something really interesting here with these executive orders, sort of broadening, I think, many Americans' understanding of how we see race.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you talk to many Latinos, Latino activists, they'll say, look, we need to center our Black communities. There are still some unattended grievances that we have to tackle, from slavery to Jim Crow to discrimination after the civil rights. But at the same time, this is not a binary discussion about race. If we continue to have a Black-white discussion about race, what you're going to find out, you're going to wake up one morning and find out the whole country speaking another language because majority is Latino. But this is not a concept about we shall overwhelm. It is still about we shall overcome. And the fact that he's proposing these policies, but also centering and reminding people we have a legacy of slavery and discrimination we need to address. So the housing, the executive order on housing does attempt to address some of this discrimination. But you have to remember, HUD also services Latino and especially Native American communities. And right now, housing is extremely important right now as they deal with COVID.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, has it been difficult to reconcile Joe Biden's past support of policies like the 1994 crime bill with what he's doing today? That was something that came up a lot on the campaign trail.
Absolutely. I mean, when we think about Joe Biden's past in terms of racial equality, it's not a good one, particularly when we think about crime, mass incarceration, and police brutality. And I think the similar sentiments could be said for Kamala Harris as well. So a lot of the work that they have to do is also about recreating trust in the Black community, that Black people can believe that they will actually do the work that is needed to be done and that they will commit to this in a different way. And also that they'll be able to self-evaluate and see, you know, the past harm that's been caused by these laws that have disproportionately impacted Black and brown communities in terms of mass incarceration, and find ways to create restorative justice. I think that's a really big deal. You know, it's a problem when we have so many states that are legalizing marijuana and you still have people who are locked up for those same charges not so long ago.
Nyambi, I'm wondering, I've said this for a while, and again, we're only 2 weeks into this new administration, but I do think that this administration, particularly when it comes to race and other policies, is really going to have to toe the line between more moderate Democrats and more progressive Democrats. We're seeing some of that split happening even in the party. I wouldn't call it a radical split, but there are definitely different ideologies. What kind of policies do you think the more activist progressive grouping here would be looking for from the Biden administration?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say. You know, I'm not, you know, I don't claim to be in the activist community. I certainly don't want to speak for them. But I think a number of things that have already been discussed, which is moving further down these roads. So, okay, you don't renew DOJ contracts with private prisons, but we really need to be talking about why we do prisons in the first place. I think many in those communities are really disenchanted with the notion of criminal justice and the ways in which we use the criminal justice system, for example, to hurt people. So it's one thing to punish people for their crimes and have them locked up. It's another thing to have people carry the label of felon for the rest of their lives, which disallows them from public housing, food assistance, access to federal resources for education, things like that. So it's a continued sort of punishment that denigrates people and makes it very difficult for them to have a living and creates all of the bad conditions that would lead people to reoffend. For example, I think that's one. I think if we're going to talk about this housing assistance, right, and you want to talk about mortgage discrimination, what are you going to do beyond just saying, okay, well, we have to do some things differently so that people can own homes? There are still people who've never been able to recover from the downturn in the economy a decade ago. And many of those were Black and brown communities that had their homes foreclosed, that had their credit ruined. And we know if you don't have credit, you can't get anything. And if you're living in places where many communities of color live, in some cases like Washington, D.C., you can't think about a home as a middle income person or even a working middle income person. So I think there are lots of areas where it's like, yes, talking about these things in theory is one, but you know, reparations is something else. And I think there's a real, I think, appetite for even that conversation to be introduced in the midst of all of these sort of executive orders, because the reparations conversation, if we know, was very hot during the Absolutely. Election cycle.
Absolutely. And it's one that's gotten a renewed attention even in the government right now. There have been bills that have been introduced and committees to study how to actually put reparations in order. We know that that is a conversation that really the Biden administration is going to have to tackle. I'm wondering, Russell, if there are any teeth to some of these executive orders. Are there certain measures of success that the Biden administration will be looking for to show that, in fact, these things are having an effect?
Well, the measurements are still up in the air. How are we going to assess how these executive orders will be graded? I do know with the executive order on Asian Americans, for example, the agency, the health agency, will have to go comb through documents to see where this anti-Asian sentiment seeped in documents. Does this affect policy? And can you point to examples of discrimination? So that's going to be one measurement that we'll be watching. Another, I think, is going to be the following of resources. I spoke to Alicia Garza of the Black to the Future Action Fund, and she said these executive orders are great, but resources are going to follow. That's one thing to say you're going to revamp the housing department, but you got to follow up with resources because you've got homes that are dilapidated, especially on the reservation and some of our urban communities. How fast does it take to, for example, fix a pipe, fix heat? Those are going to be assessments that are going to be looked at later down the road. But I think that is one measurement. But right now, it's hard to tell because there isn't a timetable that has been given to look at, say, how we measure students, for example. That's something that activists are going to be pressing for answers from the administration.
And Russell, just curious about what the reaction from Republicans has been so far to this.
You know, I've seen tepid reactions. I've seen some folks go on the talk shows, and there have been some of Republicans that say, why are we talking about race? I mean, they're going to that card again. Let's get over race. I'm offended, as Karl Rove said, that we're talking about race, that the racism still exists. So In that area, there still to be a lack of engagement. Now, on the state level, for example, in New Mexico, there is an acknowledgement that there is systemic racism, but that's going on at a state level, and that's when folks that are interacting with various communities where they see it up front. We really will get a sense of how they will be engaged when you see specific legislative policy presented, for example, the immigration reform bill or any sort of police reform. That's when we'll really get a sense and if Republicans or even some conservative Democrats are on board.
There will be lots and lots of reporting to do. Russell Contreras is a justice and race reporter at Axios. Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson is a historian and professor in the Department of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. And Dr. Niambi Carter is an associate professor of political science at Howard University. Kelly, Russell, and Niambi, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wall Street investors have become a target for a group of amateur traders from a web forum called Reddit. Users on that site managed to disrupt the plans of stock market insiders and hedge fund managers by betting against them on struggling companies like BlackBerry, AMC Theaters, and the video game retailer GameStop, whose stock price surged from $40 a share to almost $350 a share this week alone. Helene Olin is here to tell us why this matters. She's an opinion writer at The Washington Post and the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Helene, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
So this is complicated, but GameStop went up in stock price this week because a bunch of folks on Reddit decided to do what exactly?
This is, as you said, a slightly complicated story. But essentially, GameStop, which is one of those companies that turns up on retail, expected retail apocalypse lists all the time, suddenly became attractive to a group of people hanging around a Reddit board called Wall Street Bets. Because short sellers, like some of the hedge funds, like a place called Melvin Capital, which I'll get to in a minute, were betting that the stock was going to continue to fall. And these group of people on Reddit, who appear to be young guys of the type that are usually on internet boards, decided that GameStop was going to go up in price, and they started talking up the stock. And the next thing we all knew, the thing had just sort of taken off. And over the past couple of days, it has gone from opening at about $18, a little over 18 and change at the beginning of the year. It closed yesterday at just under $350. In futures trading overnight, it went up to just under $500, at which point Robinhood, which is one of the places they are trading this like crazy because it's a free trading platform, decided to basically delist the stock as of this morning. We don't know if that's temporary or permanent at this point, by the way, probably temporary.
Let's talk about the goal of this. What's the goal here? Was it to make money? Was it to disrupt Wall Street? Was it to prove a point?
That's a good question, and it appears to be all of the above. The people on this board clearly want to make money. Everybody wants to make money. But at the same time, there seems to be a huge wave of anger towards Wall Street, towards baby boomers, towards people they see as having money. And it's very much openly stated that, you know, we're going to get these Wall Street guys. We're going to make money at their expense. People are talking openly about using their profits to pay off student loans. People are putting stimulus money into this. There's definitely a wave of anger. And it's worth noting that it appears that this is, again, you know, young guys, millennials, older Gen Zers, and that the economic prospects for this group are nowhere near what the economic prospects were for, say, baby boomers at the same age. The amount of net worth they have is much lower. The amount of debt they have, mostly in the form of student debt, but also in the form of car debt and whatnot, is much higher.
Helene, how much money are the members of Wall Street Bets making from their investments in these companies like GameStop and AMC and BlackBerry? And has Wall Street really lost anything?
Well, okay, this again gets complicated. In the short run, yes, we know some of these people have made a significant amount of money. In fact, I've seen people post about paying off student loan bills in tens of thousands of dollars recently, from what they claim are trades in this stock or, you know, buying options in this stock. In the long run, the chances are incredible. Most people are going to lose out. The thing about buying into manias like this, and make no mistake, this is a mania, is that it's not going to last. And a lot of people are going to get stuck holding the bag. And it feels like right now, if you go on these boards, nobody is convinced they're going to be the ones stuck holding the hot potato here. The other group that has lost money right now is definitely some of the short sellers on Wall Street. Some of the hedge funds, and I mentioned a place called Melvin Capital before. Melvin Capital actually needed to get a bailout of several billion dollars from a couple of other hedge funds this week to and ultimately close out its short positions.
And Helene, that was sort of the point, right? I mean, they wanted these Redditors wanted to hurt hedge funds in Wall Street, right? And when I say hurt, I mean that in the grand scheme of the tens of thousands of millions of dollars that a lot of us can't even compute.
That was the point. But what nobody is realizing yet is that the hedge fund did get a bailout. And the typical investor, if they lose money on this, is not going to get a bailout. I mean, obviously they know that, but it doesn't occur to them that that might be their position at some point, I think. So
has
we
gone,
have that issue. It helps to have rich friends in this world.
It does. It definitely does. I think in general it might. And, you know, what's interesting is that this has already gotten to the point where Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is monitoring the situation. And she said in a statement, and Senator Elizabeth Warren called for the SEC to, quote, wake up and do their jobs. What are they worried about?
Well, I think there's a couple of different things. And I think the primary is actually people are quite concerned that a number of investors are going to get very badly hurt here. And that's something to be valid, that's something to be concerned about. But I think also it is concerning that you're seeing this sort of, you know, targeted going after various hedge funds and various stock positions. And nobody quite knows why and how it's happening. And I think that's frightening to people on Wall Street. I mean, you know, is it a revolution? You know, I'm old enough to remember the day traders, and I think this is, it has a lot of similarities to the day trading mania. And
but
so
isn't
I
it,
think
isn't
it's
it
going
time,
to pass.
Helene, isn't it time, I guess some folks would say, that Wall Street get disrupted, that hedge funds get disrupted, that the inequities and imbalance in wealth in the United States in particular be shook up a little bit or not?
Well, I don't think this is the way to do it. I mean, keep in mind, for all the, quote, disruption going on here and the run-up in the price of GameStop and a few other of the targeted stocks yesterday, the market itself was down quite a bit. I mean, it would take a lot of doing to go after, to really make a difference here in the overall market and in the overall Wall Street. So I think there is a level of, you know, panic on one side and, you know, over celebration on the other. Second, I do think for the most part, this is temporary. I do think this is going to end, as these manias often do. Keep in mind, some of this is also flat out being driven by the fact a lot of people are at home because of the pandemic right now, and they don't have a lot else to do with their time. So that's also factoring into this.
Right. Helene Olin is an opinion writer at The Washington Post and the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
In her first press briefing, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki set out to underscore just how different the Biden administration would be in its approach to the press from its predecessor.
There will be times when we see things differently in this room, I mean, among all of us. That's okay. That's part of our democracy. And rebuilding trust with the American people will be central to our focus in the press office and in the White House every single day.
For many White House reporters, Psaki's style is a welcome change from the more outwardly combative Trump-era press secretaries. But figuring out how to properly hold President Biden accountable, even as the new administration emphasizes its commitment to a return to normal, is just one of the calculations that journalists have had to make in recent weeks. I've got two folks here to help us talk about all this. Richard Prince is a journalist who writes a column on journalisms.com about diversity issues in the news media. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Also with us is Jay Rosen, author of Press Think, a blog about journalism in the digital age, and a professor of journalism at New York University. Jay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
We'll start with you, Jay. We had about a week of White House press briefings under the Biden administration. Your assessment so far, journalists doing the right thing?
I think it's a return to normal that is in many ways welcome. They certainly know how to ask questions and hold a government accountable, and it'll be a much different atmosphere than under Trump, who very often tried to position journalists as hate objects in order to fire up his own supporters. It's a very different approach coming from the Biden government, and it was really quite reassuring to see a normal press conference, not only at the White House, but at the State Department, where answers to questions that government officials should have were given. So far, so good on that front.
Richard, your thoughts on the press briefings from the White House so far?
I think that's great, and I agree totally with Jay. But I think that the real problem is not what is said from the podium, but how it's received. That is, a lot of people who are, because of all the disinformation they've taken in, just don't want to believe what the White House says, what the press says, and they're stuck in their silos, i.e. Fox News or similar operations, and they only will only believe what they're told by those organizations.
Jay, I'm curious about that because you've written a lot about, we are coming out of the age of, or at least the administration of misinformation, but often I say this is the age of misinformation. You've written a lot about mainstream outlets running into problems when how they frame political issues. Have you noticed this playing out in the days since President Trump left office, which we should say we are still very early into the Biden administration?
I think the looming problem for the press is not covering briefings, which are quite normal. It's something very different, which is that we have a political press that's premised its work on a kind of image of politics in which two major parties are roughly similar in the way they organize themselves, and they have different philosophies, and they fight it out for political advantage in elections and then a day-to-day of politics. And that picture of the world is underneath or serves as a foundation for journalistic practice. And that was a big problem during the Trump years because he didn't obey any of those assumptions. But it's even more of a problem now because the Republican Party has mutated into something else. And I don't think our journalists are quite prepared to deal with a party that is counter-majoritarian, meaning it doesn't respect the principle of majority rule in, for example, elections, which is trying to make it harder for people to participate and to vote, which it refuses to cut off its white supremacist wing, and as AOC said last night, draws energy from it, and is also completely hostile to evidence and facts. And as the Republican Party kind of devolves in that direction, the rules of journalism as usual simply don't apply anymore. And you can't have this sort of routines of balance and get comment from one side and comment from the other side because you have a kind of a rogue or destructive element right at the center of our politics. And I think that dealing with that Republican Party, which is anti-democratic, is going to be the major puzzle for journalists in the years ahead.
And Richard, I'm curious. There, one of the things that journalists, to Jay's point, were criticized for under the Trump administration was attempting to hold up that value of sort of both sidesism, if you will, under the guise of some quote unquote objectivity. Have we been able to break out of that more now than we were 4 years ago so far?
Oh yes, somewhat. We've learned our lessons in some ways. But the issue still remains of how what we say is received by the general public and by the doubters and haters, and that gets to the issue of trust in the news media, regardless of all these other issues, and that leads us to other issues such as who is delivering the news, how it's reported, what their frame of references are, and that leads us also to the issue of diversity and inclusion. And that's something else that's, while this whole Trump thing was going on last year in the elections, there was also the George Floyd killing. And that sort of shook the news media as well as the rest of the country into more introspection about the way they're reporting and who's doing the reporting and editing. So I think it's a really complicated jumble.
Jay, let's turn to some news here. The New York Times fired freelance editor Lauren Wolf after she tweeted, quote, "Biden landing at Joint Base Andrews now. I have chills." Is her firing what does her firing signify? Because we know the Times has also been caught up in a lot of questions about its Caliphate podcast and The Daily and other issues. So why this emphasis on firing Lauren?
Well, we don't know the backstory. I don't. I don't have sources that would tell me what the history of this appointment is. So I think we should be a little cautious about that. However, what strikes me about it is that the Times has a kind of a policy that it discourages and it penalizes journalists on its staff for saying things that critics of the Times might perceive as bias. And when your measuring stick is the perception of critics, you've entered a very dangerous territory, because there are many people in this country who would love for the New York Times to simply expire. And they are constantly claiming bias, and they constantly say that the New York Times is against them. And if the perceptions of those people can edit your staff, you have in effect handed power to your critics, to the people who want you dead. And that is something that the Times has done before. It's kind of written into its social media guidelines, which say that you shouldn't do anything that critics will perceive as bias. And I find that whole problem of perceived bias versus actual performance to be the heart of this issue. And I'm not sure the editors have a good handle on it.
I should, in full disclosure, I should say I have worked as a reporter at the New York Times for a few years. Richard, another issue, and we don't want to beat up on the New York Times here, but these are news elements that have come into our purview. Earlier this week, the New York Times published an article about European neo-Nazis that Becca Lewis, who's a researcher who studies the far right, criticized. And it sort of has the sense that early on in when the media was covering the quote-unquote alt-right, the media writ large was criticized for their coverage of the alt-right, for giving them sort of glossy, centerpieces and photos that were flattering. What are your thoughts on this? Is there still an issue, Richard, in how mainstream outlets are covering white supremacists?
Yes, there is. But to Jay's point, let me just quickly say that it depends on whose criticism is being listened to. I mean, the Times has been criticized on many different kinds of issues from many different kinds of people for years, and not just the Times, all media. But some people's criticism apparently counts more than others. So let me just make that distinction about the perceived bias. Now, on the issue of white supremacy, I think that, I wrote about a statement by the News Guild right after the storming of the Capitol, and they laid the whole, not the whole issue, but much of the issue to media literacy and misinformation. And it said, here, I'm just going to quote them, "It's clear that we need to prioritize media literacy in our education system. Too many people accept lies and conspiracy theories as fact. Media literacy education would provide our children with the skills necessary to understand the intent behind messages, understanding bias, determining fact from fiction, and looking for alternative sources of information." And they also went on to put some of the blame at the evisceration of newspapers and many of whom are being bought up by hedge funds, the news holes being cut, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, since this whole issue of white supremacy, white nationalism is a national issue, not just in Washington, all those places that have news deserts where they can't get the local information that they need are feeding the misinformation, the white supremacy, the social media networks. And that is that's a problem that, of course, we need to address as well.
Jay, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, has the media, quote unquote, the media gotten better or more specific or, less afraid, I should say, of calling out racism?
I think there's been a change in that, and they're freer to say this is racist. I think there has been more suspicion of euphemisms that kind of cushion the blow.
Trump, you mean forced, like racially tinged?
Yeah, things like that. I think Trump forced a kind of reckoning with that. Although our earlier subject, the New York Times, still has this funny way of talking where it's very formal in its language and kind of distant and institutional in its voice. And that can be discordant a lot of times with some of the very threatening realities that are in the news these days. But yeah, being a little bit more direct in that way was one of the results of the Trump years, as well as more willingness to say this is untrue, this is a lie, to confront falsehood directly. Those were some of the big changes we saw in journalism over the last 5 years.
And Richard, what do you want to see more media outlets do to address, some of these coverage issues going forward? Is it a question of, you know, hiring more people of color? Is it a question of really understanding? What should they be doing right now?
Well, hiring more people of color is certainly part of the resolution of this. Just more sensitivity to the diversity in this country. And I have to go back again to the whole issue of media literacy. It's just alarming that you have all these people out there who just refuse to believe the truth. And the media have a role in establishing trust in the truth that they are putting out there. So the people,
I was going to ask you that, Richard. Is it a question of the media not being clear enough in its questioning, for example?
Yeah, but I just think it's there's too many people who are dismissive of the truth. And how do we deal with that? I just think we just have to educate the public a little better and do what's necessary internally so that the truth that they will understand is relevant to them is part of the daily news diet.
We can only hope these things come to light. Richard Prince is a journalist who publishes a column on journalisms.com about diversity in news media. And Jay Rosen is the author of Press Think, a blog about journalism in the digital age, and a professor of journalism at New York University. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Alrighty, folks, that's it for us today. Thank you for tuning in this week. Amy Walter will be with you tomorrow. And of course, if you have thoughts or ideas for the show, call us at 877-8MYTAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a voice memo recorded on your phone to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. The show is on Twitter at The Takeaway, and I'm there too at Tanzina Vega. And before I go, we're going to give a shout out to the crew that makes this show every week. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Alexandra Boti and Amber Hall are our senior producers. Our line producer is Jackie Martin. Our producer crew is Jose Olivares, Ethan Oberman, Jason Tureski, Meg Dalton, and Patricia Jacob. And our board operator this week was Sham Sundra. Vince Fairchild was our director and sound designer, and David Gable is our executive assistant. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.